It's podcast time, and one of the sad things I hate about not having a radio show is missing certain guests, and this is one of those guests. This was a joy to always interview this man because he speaks an awful lot of sense. He was a politician. He now knows what it's about, so he's got this incredible knowledge. And it's, I would say, downtown in business, but it's not even that. It's downtown in England now, because I'm with Frank McKenna.
Hi, Peter. Great to see you.
Downtown everywhere.
Yeah, we're in 9 locations across the country now. Started, obviously, in Liverpool 21 years ago, would you believe? And now we're in all the core cities, but we also cover Lancashire, Cheshire, Wolverhampton, do a bit there as well. Right up to Newcastle and obviously London. So it's motor and we're doing okay.
I'm talking to Frank McKenna. Explain what downtown is.
So we do three things very quickly. So we're a public affairs agency that advises the private sector how to deal with public sector agencies, local councils, politicians and so on. And we do an awful lot to bring those organisations together. So we're responsible for an awful lot of the public-private sector partnerships that exist across the country, particularly around regeneration projects. We host about 100 events a year across the country, and that gives us an opportunity to introduce our members to other people who are part of the Downtown Network, and obviously they can potentially do business together. RFD very cleverly, about 2 years ago now this was, though maybe even three, worked out that of those people that we facilitated introductions with, about £2 billion worth of deals have been done across the network, so that's great. And then we have a communications platform, so if you want to get news out about what your business is up to, we've got a following of about 100,000 people, and they can go onto our website or onto our social media platforms and find out what your business is doing.
Frank, what clout have you got with politicians and councils?
I think it depends what the issue is, who the politician is, and how effective they want to be in terms of engaging with the private sector. We still have, unfortunately, in many parts of our country, people who would prefer to deal with private sector organisations who are going to tell them what they want to hear rather than what they need to hear. So I suppose and suspect we are seen as a bit of a disruptor, and not necessarily people's favourite organisation to deal with from time to time. But the flip side of that coin is they know that if we do criticise, we do so in a constructive way, and even if it's reluctant, they do listen to us. Where I think we've really started to make a difference over the past 6 or 7 years is, as I say, bringing those companies to the table who can help local authorities, local government to deliver some of their projects, and as I say, helping to create those public-private sector partnerships. So we are influential. It's not for me to say how much influence we have, but certainly, you know, if we make a phone call to a mayor, to a chief executive, to a minister, shadow minister, they'll take the call.
Simple as that. What advantage, before we talk about the subjects we're going to talk about, what advantage would a business have coming to you? That if they're listening now and they go, oh, what's this about?
Well, I think if you're not into your politics and you're not really that bothered about public sector and what they're up to, the events that we host, and you very happily do some of the awards events with us, they are spectacular. And the quality of those events and the quality of the people in the room is second to none. And so if the only thing you want to do is grow your business and sell more stuff, then our network is definitely for you. But, and it's a big but, you've got to be the business owner who wants to get involved in the network. We don't accept companies joining and then sending middle managers or salespeople to our events. That just doesn't work. There are networks out there where you can do that, and that's fine, and we'd rather you go there, because you will only get value out of downtown if the decision maker from the business comes into the room for those events. So we're very clear about that. It's individuals who are decision makers within the business. usually business owners. And as I say, we've helped facilitate about £2 billion worth of deals. So it's worth joining for that. Equally, if you want to know what's going on in your city or in your region, then we have all of the decision makers from the local authorities, from the mayoral offices, from Parliament, coming to our events and telling you what's happening.
How can they find out more about Downtown?
Just go onto our website, all the W's, downtowninbusiness.com, and you will see all that stuff I've told you about, but also you'll get a flavour of the events that we've got coming up.
Fab. I'm with Frank McKenna. When Frank did my radio show, he always made a lot of sense, and we had critics, of course, but a lot of people took from his information. So we're going to do a generalised conversation now. We're going to talk about France, he's just come back from. We're going to talk about Brexit, general elections, the local city councils, and Rwanda. I thought I'd throw that one in. So first of all, what were you doing in France?
So there's a big property festival happens every year called MIPIM in Cannes. So very lovely backdrop landscape to this whole event. And we have, across our network this year, four of the cities that we work in. Manchester, Newcastle, of course Liverpool and London. There with big exhibitions and obviously lots of businesses from those cities in Cannes during that time as well. So we go across to support our businesses, our network, and we also host a couple of events whilst we're over there as well. And again, the great thing about our events is we get all of the chief executives from those cities into the room. So even if you don't get to speak to them on the stands, you can come to our lunch that we do. It's about 50 people in the room. We take over a restaurant for a couple of hours and all those chief executives turn up very kindly for us, do a presentation and then speak to the guests. So I think it's a worthwhile exercise for businesses who are looking to, again, perhaps engage with other companies, but equally who are looking to find out what's going on in the investment market, both nationally and internationally. And from a city's perspective, I think it's crucially important if you're looking to put yourself in the shop window to be there. There's 23, 24,000 people there over a three-day period. So a great opportunity for cities, as I say, to showcase the opportunities and potential from an investment perspective that they have. And I'll tell you the interesting thing this year for me was that Liverpool, for all the problems and controversy surrounding the local authority, they were there. They were in the room, and I thought that was great. I think it was a brave call, but I think it was the right one. Birmingham, which of course went bust earlier this year, not around at all. Leeds, who I understand are in a little bit of financial trouble, not there at all. So it wasn't as big and as brash a show as Manchester were able to put on or London were able to put on, but the fact that Liverpool were in the room, I thought was great.
That's fantastic. Now, before we talk about all these subjects, we'll start with the city councils. We've got to remember, I think it was 4 years ago that the pandemic started. 4 years ago. And whatever we say about this government or this city council or whatever, we keep forgetting that we've had mega, mega financial problems, haven't we?
Yeah, and I think that the problem with the pandemic is always going to be an issue for, it's an issue for the whole world. Of course it was, to call the pandemic. But I think we were particularly hit because we didn't have the framework and the infrastructure in place that, say, it happened in 2010, we would have had. So the NHS was already struggling. Waiting lists were already going through the roof. Educational attainment was going down. Poverty was going up. The gap between the rich and the poor was growing. Austerity has taken hold of this country in a way that I don't think was ever planned. But unfortunately, it's the consequence of the financial policies that were pursued initially by a coalition government and then by subsequent Conservative governments. So I don't think we're in the best place in terms of being able to deal with the pandemic as well as we may have done, as I say, a decade or so ago. But then, and this is what disappoints me about the inquiry that's currently going on. Okay, it may be tittle-tattle and it might give good headlines for the tabloids to see Boris Johnson and Matt Hancock and Rishi Sunak and Dominic Cummings swearing on a WhatsApp message or calling each other fit to burn. But if that inquiry is to be of any use whatsoever to us as a country, we're spending literally hundreds of millions of pounds on this thing. Surely we need to know how the decision-making was taking place, what the process was, and who was looking at the longer-term consequences of those short-term decisions that were taking place at the time. So I'll give you just one example of this. We had, for the first 6 weeks, I think, a recognition from everybody in the country that this was something different, something new, and we had to be cautious. And a lockdown was absolutely the right decision. But I think when you start to dig into the statistics, relatively quickly it emerged that there were certain types of people who were at risk. But they continued to lock the whole country down, and they did it for a long, long period of time. They also introduced, initially, an 80% of your salary furlough if you were lucky enough to be in paid
work. Which I was one that wasn't, and one of the 2.8 million, and you were as well.
Correct. So they made that decision at 80%. Now, again, I sort of get that for a six-week period. But then surely at some point you have to say, hang on, we've also told people that they can have a mortgage break, so most people aren't paying the mortgages. The fact that they're working from home or not working at all means that they're saving on all the expenses that are usually associated with going to work, travel expenses, lunches, all that sort of thing. And then if you look at that 80% threshold and you look at what that cost the country, it took Sunak, who was the Chancellor at the time, I think I'm right in saying, almost 6 months before that amount was reduced. That was an absolute nonsense. Cost us a fortune. People were having, literally, I know people were having, saving up for new cars, extensions on the house, 3 holidays a year. It's what people do. And then, and this is what does amaze me about this inquiry, there doesn't appear to have been any conversation about the longer term impact of those lockdowns, both in terms of the economic impact, which has been devastating, and on the longer term health consequences that those lockdowns were going to have. So forget just the waiting lists, the number of people who've died through cancer because they weren't able to be seen, the mental health issues in this country have gone through the roof, whereby we've now got a massive problem with worklessness. Literally millions of people saying we can't go to work. We're mentally not capable of going back to work. Who was looking at that piece as a problem in terms of those decisions that were being made? So I'm not sitting here either, by the way, in hindsight. I was saying this during the pandemic because I was fortunate enough to be involved with conversations with local authority chief executives, with national politicians, with public health officials. And I was making these points then. I had 2 kids who were sat at home, not being properly educated. The online lessons were an absolute joke. I felt sorry for the teachers, but they were an absolute joke. I'm fortunate enough that I've been able to pay for private tuition so that my kids could catch up. What about all those poor sods out there who couldn't? What about all those poor sods, by the way, who didn't have computers when those online lessons were taking place? All of those things, from the kids to the fact that we couldn't see our relatives if they were sick, the scandal over the homes, which came out best, I think, in a recent documentary, not a documentary, a drama on ITV, what's called Breathless, I think it was called, wasn't it, something. And, you know, for me, that pandemic, bad though it was really poorly mismanaged. And as I say, we as an organisation were calling long before it happened for the country to open up again and for us to start to get back to a sense of normality. And if you look at what's happened across the world, those countries that actually did that, Scandinavian countries in particular, but certain states in America as well, you will see that their death rates were no worse. But of course, the economies have all bounced back far quicker.
I'm talking to Frank McKenna. Frank, you were a politician. You're a very successful businessman now. Why would anybody want to be a politician in this day and age where they're treated like football managers, four games and you're out. Also, the violence and threats. Do you see a problem running a country, forget which government, running a country with politicians? Why would they become a politician?
I think it's a huge problem and challenge that we have as a country, as a democracy, because I wouldn't go back into politics. I've been asked, and I've just, you know, it's almost like somebody's asking me to cut my right arm off, to be honest, because why would you? And I think the difference, listen, I was a politician over 20 years ago now, high-profile politician. I did go back into local government for a short period of time, but certainly not into the sort of senior position I was previously in. And back in, so it was from 89 to about 2001, we didn't have social media. There was a level of respect. It wasn't daft respect. It wasn't people wouldn't tell you if they thought they disagreed with your opinion or the view or the policy you were espousing. But equally, there wasn't the nastiness. There wasn't an ability for people to get at you minute by minute because, as I say, social media didn't exist. And what you certainly didn't have were these extremist groups quite literally plotting to kill politicians. And that's what we're asking people to deal with now. And when you see that, I think the last count was 8 parliamentarians who have got literally day-to-day, 24-hour bodyguard cover, what has the country come to? I don't know what the answer is, because the explosion in social media means you can't put that genie in the bottle. Do we have to say to our politicians, get off social media? Well, of course, that closes down a huge communications platform for those people, and they use it for not just expressing views, but also putting out appeals in their constituencies, telling people what they're up to and so on and so forth. But for £91,000 a year, that's what the MP's salary has just gone up to. And again, I know there's people listening to this podcast who will say, wow, that's a massive amount of cash. What the fuck are they doing? Listen, honestly, spend a week in the shoes of an MP and then tell me £91,000 is too much money. In fact, I don't think it's anywhere near enough. And I think that unless and until we start to respect parliamentarians in the way that we used to, and listen, I understand and appreciate that some of that respect has been lost by MPs themselves. But unless you've got a job with respect, unless you've got a job where you feel safe going in and out of work, and unless you are being remunerated in a fair way, and I think at this moment in time, an MP, a backbench MP, should be on at least £120,000 a year, particularly if you live outside of London, because it's a horrendous life, Pete. Really is. Honestly, I worked in Parliament for 7 years for a Member of Parliament. And I thought, then, not for me. It's just not for me. And unless and until, as I say, we can start to return to the view that those people who sit representing us in Parliament are worth having and worth supporting, then we are going to see a deterioration in the quality of those people who sit on those green benches. And we all hear the comments that are flying around at the moment. You know, even if you love Rishi Sunak as a Conservative supporter, or you really support Keir Starmer and you want him to win the next general election, nobody sits there and thinks they and the teams around them are the same as what Thatcher had back in the 70s and 80s, the same as Blair had in the late 90s and early noughties. Everybody says to me, well, the calibre of the people in there now, just not the same, Frank. Well, no bloody wonder. You know, you basically, be careful what you wish for. So if you want to keep people on low pay, if you want to continue to turn a blind eye while these poor sods are being slaughtered on social media and so on, you're going to get what you're giving.
It's interesting you say that, because I always said over the years I was on radio, England is a business. The UK is a business. Business people, because of what you do downtown, as you said, we want the boss there and nobody else. Those bosses earn a great deal of money, but they run major companies. England is the biggest company, so why shouldn't they get paid right? So we're definitely on the same wavelength as this, because people don't see it. By the way, no one will agree with us right now that's listening. No one's going to agree with one word we say about this. But as you said, step in their shoes. Let's move on to the general election, whenever it's going to be, because this is not dated. This is a podcast they can listen to. It is surely and totally a foregone conclusion that Keir is going to be our next Prime Minister. It's a foregone conclusion. But what worries me about that is, what chance has he got with the state of the country it's in?
Well, he would be the first person to tell you that it's not a foregone conclusion. And what worries the Labour Party more than anything else is complacency. And obviously I know this because I was a Labour politician. I'm still close to a lot of people who are senior within the party. But I talk to people on the Conservative side as well. I will predict that the election's going to be on October the 10th. So there you go. That's Frank McKenna prediction. That's just from the various rumours and conversations I have in Westminster and beyond. But I think in terms of the inheritance, I think it will be a Labour government. And I hope it's a healthy majority, not because it's Labour, but because I think without a healthy majority, you can't get on and get things done. And we do need somebody to be able to come in and radically reform what the direction the country's going in at this moment in time. So, yeah, it's a mess that they're inheriting to a point. But again, I always say this to people. Great Britain is a fantastic country. We've still got magnificent assets. We've got brilliant people, really entrepreneurial in terms of our outlook. And I think there are certain things that we can do relatively quickly that will give the next government a much better chance of reviving the economy and the country's fortunes if they choose to take the sort of things that I would see as I say, not costing a lot of money, but really improving and progressing things for us. I'll give you a couple of examples. One, we need to have a grown-up, mature conversation with our partners in Europe. So I would absolutely not advocate rejoining the EU. And no politician would. We don't want to go back to the days of all that bloody, you know, paperwork. Every day. Oh, and Pete, it was like, you know, every day you were waking up, it was like Groundhog Day, wasn't it? Oh, Brexit. It was the only thing that politicians were discussing. We don't want to go back to that. But equally, are you telling me seriously, even if you are the most ardent Brexiteer, that 52% of our country voted for no trade with Europe? Or trade with Europe that was going to be so difficult that our exports would go through the floor. Are you saying that we voted for a Brexit that meant that if you want to get abroad, you're going to be queuing in Dover for about 24 hours before you can get a ferry? Are you telling me that we don't want to have, with our European neighbours, a policy that enables us to protect our borders effectively? Nonsense. And unfortunately, I think the Conservative Party's psychodrama, which started with Europe and is now sort of finishing with immigration, means that European leaders simply don't take Sunak seriously. They don't think he's a person they can do business with. Likewise, Liz Truss, likewise, Boris Johnson, because they've lost control. It's an unmanageable party, isn't it? You look at that Conservative Party and you think, God,
you mean the one with all the prime ministers?
Yeah, well, yeah, you know. I mean, you made the point earlier about, you know, football managers. Well, the Tory party is a bit like that now, isn't it? Oh, well, you know, the budget didn't work, did it? So should we try somebody else? So if you're a European leader, if you're Macron, and you're sat there thinking, do we need to do a deal with this guy? You're probably thinking, not really. Starmer has a great opportunity, I think, of coming into power in October and saying to those European leaders, can we sit down and have a mature conversation? Because actually, although we're losing out big time, you guys are losing out small time as well. And small time at the moment, given the geopolitical consequences on the economies of all those European nations, it matters. So if we can improve their economy by 1 or 2%, but we can improve ours by 4 or 5%, why wouldn't we have those conversations? That costs us nothing other than a negotiation and a conversation. Mm. And I think that sort of policy change of direction will actually bring a freshness to the country that we're probably long overdue. And the other thing, and I think Rachel Rees, as the Shadow Chancellor, has started to do a great job as far as this is concerned, we need to start to rebuild that confidence of business, that if a government says it's going to do something, it's going to do it. So you're not going to get a Labour government standing up and saying, we are going to invest in a roads programme for the next 10 years and we're going to spend 2 billion quid. And then 12 months down the line, because a few of the backbench MPs say, oh, we don't like this in our constituency, they pull the plug. And if you think that doesn't happen, I refer you to HS2. So we've got businesses within the downtown network who had spent literally millions of pounds preparing to build HS2 from Birmingham into the north of England. The plug was pulled. They just don't walk away from those contracts. We'll still have to pay those millions of pounds at some point back to those businesses. But of course, the time will never be compensated for. So if the Conservative government continues somehow squeak through and won an election, there is no way that businesses and investors are going to be looking at UK PLC as a safe place to invest. So equally, a new government, I think, brings an opportunity for whether it be Rachel Reeves or others around that cabinet to say to business, you can trust us and you can invest in us. And the final point I'll make on this in terms of Labour government, which I think is crucially important and certainly relevant in terms of local government, is that they will give more power, more responsibility and an opportunity for more resources to people like Andy Burnham, Steve Rotherham, Tracy Braben down in Leeds, because they recognise that actually, if you're going to start to sort out the chaos and the mess that we've been in now for too many years, you have to allow local people, local elected politicians, to get on and do that job.
You've led me right into that question. Local politicians and local councils, not just Liverpool. I think Liverpool's above the others, but they're in the doo-doo, aren't they?
Listen, over 80% of budgets within most local authorities now are spent on social care and childcare. So that leaves them with a relatively minuscule amount of cash to deal with things that we all moan at councils for not doing, don't we? Fix the potholes. Keep the libraries open, put community centres to the fore. All those nice things, right? But they're not statutory services. This is what people don't understand. You don't have to fix the roads as local authority. You don't have to keep libraries open as local authority. You certainly don't have to provide marketing and events budgets. You know, you sat in Liverpool now. You're thinking about the cash that we put into getting the Eurovision Song Contest here. Now, there's a net gain to Liverpool in terms of our profile, in terms of the marketing of the city, in terms of our hotels and our hospital. The council doesn't get that money. So the council had to lay out all this cash to bring that particular event to us. Similarly, you look at Birmingham. Birmingham was on the world stage through its Commonwealth Games. It was a fantastic couple of weeks. Everybody said it was one of the best Commonwealth Games ever to take place. City Council's gone bust this year. Now, that's not because of the Commonwealth Games, but nevertheless, that's what local authorities are faced with. Well, we can spend some money on this, but actually, those statutory services, which are increasing in cost, they're the things that are killing them. And Liverpool, it's not only through the financial resource implications that we've had through those austerity measures that I mentioned earlier, but also because of the controversy around the former mayor. Police investigation, still not closed. Nobody's been taken to court yet. Nobody's in jail. So, again, you know, the
nobody's city's...
No, city's reputation's been, you know, forget the individuals involved. I always say, Pete, you know, slow justice is no justice, so I do feel sorry. Whatever the outcome of this, I will still say, and I get brickbats from people saying this. I can't understand why, really. You know, if you are a high-profile person, as Johansson was, for example, right? And you're arrested. And 4 years later, you still haven't been... I think there's something wrong with the system.
Absolutely. Now,
if you think there isn't, I don't know what world you're in.
Absolutely.
And I just, again, say, put yourself in that guy's shoes.
Because his life's on hold for 4 years and still on hold.
At the age he is, and this, I haven't spoken to Joe for a couple of years now, so this isn't, you know, a mate of mine. He was a colleague when he was a mayor. Of course we had to deal with him. But, you know, I don't care who it was. If it was Boris Johnson, who I really didn't have any time for, but if we had him on the hook for 4 years, I'd be saying, it's not fair. You know, our justice system needs to improve so much as far as that's concerned. But in relation to Liverpool, That was a big hit to our reputation. Because again, Pete, you remember, back in the 80s, it was, oh, there's Liverpool, brown envelopes, this sort of stuff going on, that's going on, that's going on. And to have all that rehashed and that reputation damaged on the back of what had been a good decade, actually, on the back of European Capital of Country in 2008, you know, that was really poor. And then some of the things that have happened in Birmingham, a city where we do some great business and we love the people of Birmingham. It's a fabulous, fabulous place. Again, you look at that and you think, well, did they know that the Equal Pay Act was going to come to the fore? And did they know that they were going to end up having to pay millions of pounds in back pay compensation to women? Again,
but these aren't business people. These are people who are going to council to represent, but are not trained in business. Yeah. There are so many people in councils in this country that don't know anything about business.
Yeah, and I think that's where you would say, you know, what do you want your local government to be? Do you want it to be commercial? In which case, you know, get ready for your bins to start to be charged at much higher rates than they are at the moment. Get ready for particular services to be, for a fee to be applied to them. Or do we actually want a local government system in this country which is fairly funded and actually where local councils are able to keep a bit more of the money they raise locally rather than sending it all back to the Treasury into Whitehall. So I think local government reform is something that another government, a Labour government, I suspect, can look at. But given the number of problems that, as you said earlier, Keir Starmer and his team are likely to inherit, I think that's going to be a little bit down the line. Where I think they will be able to prioritise and make a difference is at that sort of regional government level with those mayors. So if you look at what's called trailblazer deals that Manchester and Birmingham were given last year, that basically enables Andy Burnham and Andy Street, who's the West Midlands mayor, to raise a certain precept of cash, ring fence it and spend it on the priorities that they think are right for their region. And the more of that we can get, I think the sooner we start to level up. Do you remember that phrase? Level up the country.
Now, you've mentioned some mayors. We'll touch briefly on this. The Mayor of London. Is he trying to create two countries?
No. Sadiq Khan runs, again, I say this without any bias because people can tell from my accent. I have an emotional attachment to Liverpool. I think Manchester's an absolutely fantastic city, one that really downtown has been adopted by. There's a big organisation in that city. As I say, we do a lot of work in Birmingham and Leeds as well. But for me, you go a long way to find a city better than London. You know, I used to say,
do you think he's doing a good job?
I think he's doing a good job, but I think equally, you've got to put these things into perspective. And the idea that Sadiq Khan, even if he was the biggest personality, the biggest character on the planet, and he's not in the same way as Boris Johnson was, for example, in your face, London, 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 we're doing this, we're doing this, we're doing this. He's a very thoughtful guy. I think he's operating through a manifesto which he told everybody about 4 years ago in terms of ULEZ, which is a controversial policy around air quality in the city. He told people his views around the European Union, the fact that he thought London needed to continue to be open to business, to foreign investment. In my opinion, it's not controversial about that. But the idea that any one person could change the culture of that city is for the birds. They have an impact on some things, of course. But what he's being criticised for, largely the policing of that city and the area around Westminster, that's not even in his bloody remit. He doesn't have any power over that. That's Westminster. That's a totally separate thing. So I think that, listen, he's an easy target for politicians who are a bit thick, and I count Lee Anderson in that number. But to suggest, as some have, that Sadiq Khan has ruined London or changed London. As I say, you only have to go and visit the place to know that that's not true. Do I think Sadiq Khan is the best mayor that we have in the country? No, I don't. I don't know Sadiq that well. I think he does a reasonably good job. But let's not overestimate the power and influence these guys have either.
Frank, we're coming towards the end again because we talk forever and you're a fascinating man. On a personal level, and this is a personal level now, I've had major problems with the trains from Lime Street to Euston, and I've lost a lot of work in my own little way. Nothing to them, means nothing to anyone, but I've lost work. When are those trains going to get sorted?
Well, you say means nothing to them and it's just Pete Price. You then basically add up all the little Pete Prices that there are across the whole of the north of England. And when you look at our productivity levels, which are on the floor, I always say in the north of England, we don't have a productivity problem. We have a connectivity problem because we can't bloody get anywhere. And, you know, getting to London used to be a joy, didn't it? You know, we used to all have a little moan of Virgin. If they draw out your favourite
Virgin.
Wine.
Always right. Love Virgin.
If they draw out your red Virgin. Or white wine, you'd yeah. be saying, oh, what's happening to Virgin? Yeah. Right, now again, I would... You'd have to look back and you'd have to... I remember Louise Ellman, who was a Liverpool MP for a number of years, leader of Lancashire County Council. She was my boss for a time. Fabulous politician. And she was chair of the Transport Select Committee when Virgin had the franchise taken off them. And I remember her very clearly saying, this is the biggest mistake we have ever made. Not just the fact that we took it off Virgin, which was basically a little kick at Branson because somebody in the government... He'd upset somebody. But also because we gave it to Avanti, who had no experience of running networks in the UK. So it was always going to be a challenge for those guys. And, you know, if you say to me, when's it going to be sorted? Well, the Northern powerhouse leaders got together earlier this week and they've written a letter now. So this is Burnham, Steve Rotherham, it's Tracy Braben, who's the mayor of West Yorkshire, I think there's a couple of others up in the northeast as well. They've written a letter to the government asking for them to remove the franchise from Avanti. That's how bad it's got. It's an absolute shit show. And, you know, for me, whether it's Avanti as an operator or whether it's, again, the whole system that needs to be reformed, I don't know. But I think what is clear to everybody increasingly is that you can't have 99 different operators. Loads of different networks. It's got, if there was ever a service that was crying out for renationalisation, right, and a strategy that just said, how can we get people from A to B, then rail must be the one. And it's so important, because, as I say, it massively impacts on the economic performance of the country.
How do you see the future, last question, for Liverpool?
Oh, I think it's an art city here where we're sat. If you look at, again, I mentioned, right, so I'm in Mippin, France, and I'm looking at Manchester's stand, massively impressive. They've got a great narrative, got a great story to tell. You go to London again, likewise. Go to Newcastle, they had a DJ on, it was buzzing, there was a bit Guinness being served in Belfast. And Liverpool, inevitably, given the problems and challenges we've already spoken about, not as high profile, but you walk around Cannes, and they say to English, yeah, from Liverpool. Ah, Liverpool, the Beatles, football, the waterfront. Blah, blah. You don't get that reaction from any other city in the UK. None. And I include London in that. We have something within Liverpool that is special. And unfortunately, for all sorts of reasons, we haven't yet quite managed over the past couple of decades to bottle what that is and sell it as effectively as we need to the rest of the world. But you can't show me a better city with the natural assets that we have here. And I start with the waterfront and I can end there in a sense. But look what's happening within our education and knowledge quarter. Life sciences, health, entrepreneurship, academics that are so bright that they're being invited onto international platforms every other week to express what their views are on all sorts of different issues. We've got so much opportunity and potential here. But ultimately, you know, it's about getting that narrative right, getting it consistent, and doing what Manchester has managed to do. And again, some people criticise me for mentioning the M word as much as I do, but listen, I'm telling you now, I get asked about Manchester. So internationally, this is an interesting point. If I go to the States, if I go to Brussels, if I go to Cannes, as I did last week, and I mention Liverpool, wow, Liverpool. In the UK, it's, oh, Liverpool. And that's our problem. So internationally, our reputation's really strong. Somehow, we've got to convert that reputation that we have internationally into a national reputation that is strong as well. And as I say, the reason why people in the UK say to me, how did he do it in Manchester, is basically for 25 years, that place has had consistent messaging, consistent leadership, and has grown like Topsy. It's now, unarguably, the capital of the North. 30 years ago, it was Liverpool. Now, I'm not suggesting that we're ever going to catch or even surpass Manchester, but I tell you what, we should be doing a lot better than we're doing at the moment.
Sorry, that was the last question, but I've got to ask, and this is a brief answer. Are you pleased with your new stadium? Because I believe all the corporate has been sold out. It's looking spectacular. That's a hard question to answer, isn't it?
Oh, Everton Stadium is going to be the best in Europe. I've seen it. You know, I've been down there and looked at it. It's an absolutely fantastic facility. So I'm absolutely delighted with that. Problem we've got is we haven't got a team at the moment that's fit to play there. So let's hope we can turn that round over the next decade or so as well.
Frank McKenna, wow.
Cheers, Pete.
Thank you so much for joining us on our podcast. Why not subscribe? You know it's free. So join us and tell your friends. It's great going on walks and doing whatever you want to do and then putting Pete Price on. We've got a back catalogue of over 100 interviews. Join us. Subscribe. It's free.